Things have been tough lately for dreamers. They say dreaming's dead. And no one does it anymore. But it's not dead, it's just it's been forgotten. Removed from our language. Nobody teaches it, so no one knows it exists. And the dreamer's banished to obscurity. Well, I'm trying to change all that, and I hope you are too. By dreaming every day. Dreaming with our hands and dreaming with our minds. Our planet is facing the greatest problems it's ever faced. Ever. So whatever you do, don't be bored. This is absolutely the most exciting time we could have possibly hoped to be alive. And things are just starting.
Welcome to the Three Film Egos. I'm your hirsute host, Isaac Jensen, and with me, as always, is Utah's whitest black child, Clayton Godby.
Got some pita chips and hummus.
And our resident vegan dreadlocked Portlandier, Ryan Cragen.
I made myself tacos tonight.
This is a film discussion podcast where we each pick a film based on a predetermined theme or topic and then talk about anything but. There will be tangents. There will not be spoiler alerts. Consider yourselves warned. On this episode, Dreams.
Cool, should we get down to business?
Yeah, should we talk about Dreams?
Talk about Dreams.
All right. What do we have? We had Waking Life, Paprika, and The Science of Sleep.
Yes.
Which one should we start with?
I'd say either Science of Sleep or Waking Life. I don't know. If you want to take a lead, if not, I can take the lead.
I'll jump straight off. I chose Waking Life because when I thought of Dreams, it was the first movie that came to my head. This is a movie I discovered when I was first getting heavily into philosophy and reading lots of philosophy. I was recommended this movie by somebody else that was into it, and I watched it, and it blew me away. Because it's not really a movie per se. You basically have one character that's not named, actually, in the movie at all, who's going through basically a constant lucid dream, and he's first partially observing characters and listening to the conversations, and he starts to become part of the conversation, and he starts to learn that he's actually dreaming. And every character that he meets is basically talking about some kind of a different philosophical idea. Most of it's on the meaning of life, reality, free will, identity, appearance. And I think it's great. What did you guys think?
Yeah, this is the first time I'd seen this. And it is, like you said, it's actually not necessarily a narrative film. It's more philosophical lectures that are painted pretty.
Mm-hmm. I forgot to mention it's rotoscoped. So
yeah, it's rotoscoped.
It was all shot digitally and then rotoscoped.
Yeah, this is the first feature using rotoscope, right?
I believe so. And he also did it again later on. Linklater did it on with a Scanner Darkly, but...
Right. And now you see it everywhere.
His first foray into it.
And so I thought it was interesting to look at, but I found myself at certain points finding it difficult to latch on to it, to kind of lose myself in it, because it is so conversational and so philosophical. I mean, all the topics were interesting to me, but it's just like... Even though it was pretty to look at, I found myself kind of focusing on all the details of the image as opposed to listening to what was being said.
See, I didn't have that problem. I mean, and it is beautiful animation. I think it's really cool. And you can tell that it's rotoscope. You can tell it was the actual people at first. And that's an interesting dynamic. And I wasn't having a hard time keeping up with the conversation or listening to it or caring. Well, I guess actually caring about it was what I was having a hard time doing, or seeing why each of the conversations related to each other, or why the movie was one rather than a series of short films or something like that. Yeah, but I mean, a lot of the topics brought up are interesting in the way of kind of like a non-plot, kind of philosophically driven, meandering film. I'll usually pick like a Terrence Malick, but this was still a good treatment of that concept.
Are any of you guys lucid dreamers? Have you ever actually tried to lucid dream and know that you're dreaming and try to control it? Have you ever done any of that sort of thing? So yeah, I've definitely tried that quite a bit, especially after inspired by this film. And it kind of plays like a dream, because in my dreams, I change scenes a lot, and they don't necessarily ever tie in together. But there's always something happening, and it's always really intense, and it doesn't always make sense at all. And they just sort of keep coming organically, and just sort of just – and you, I don't know. That's kind of the feeling that I get when I watch this movie.
And
an unknown character in an unknown land that just sort of ends up where he's at and just goes through these experiences. But he's not really sure what's happening the whole time either. So he's just as lost as you are.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to think about it, that it's almost like being in a dream rather than being in a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And back to your question, I have a lot of experience with lucid dreaming. When I lived in Rochester, I had a roommate that was very much into that concept, and he got me in the habit of having a bunch of different cues, kind of like in the movie Inception, having totems that you can check and see if you're dreaming or awake. I had kind of a list of those that I would check every hour on the hour, not because I thought that I would catch myself very often necessarily, but to make that a part of my reality so that hopefully in my dreaming state, my mind would implant something like that, and then I would catch myself. And so that kind of conversation or idea is in at least two of these films that we have about dreaming, of that lucid dreaming, trying to control your dream, or the idea that how do you know whether you're dreaming or awake? I like that theme in Waking
right.
Life.
False awakening, yeah. where you think you're going to finally wake up out of your dream and you're still dreaming. That's happened to me before, but it usually happens in nightmares, not actual dreams. Oh, man.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever had anything as intense as you guys are describing. It's actually pretty rare for me to remember dreams. Even at the moment I wake up, I'll be aware I had dreams, and there'll be some vivid imagery and conceptual ideas about what I was dreaming about. But I'm so groggy that it just leaves my brain after the next, two or three minutes. And
yeah,
it's been
I have
for probably the last three or four years. So I really am not a very active dreamer.
I think you wake up under the wrong circumstances. It's a lot easier to forget where you were dreaming. It's a lot easier to snap out of it. But I've been in dreams where I've literally taken notes. I've been in the dream knowing that I'm dreaming, and I've thought, this is so awesome, I need to take notes on how cool this is. And then I woke up and realized I didn't actually write a note at all. I was in a dream. Very strange things. Yeah.
At the same time, even though I don't have much experience with lucid dreaming, I have had lucid dreaming. And I think this movie, Waking Life, did an exceptional job of portraying what that is, what that experience is like.
Absolutely. I think that's why maybe I like it so much, is because it kind of opened up the doors to focusing on your dream state, and actually trying to be there with your dream state instead of just being kind of on a ride that you don't ever remember. I mean, if you spend so much of your life in your dream state,
right,
I would like to know more about it, and for reasons explained in this film, you can pretty much do whatever you want once you're in control, which is pretty crazy.
Yeah, which is realistic as well. I've had friends who were more skilled at lucid dreaming than I ever became when I was almost obsessed with it, who could teach themselves skills while in their dream, would practice snowboarding tricks while dreaming, and they believed that just the muscle memory or the belief that you could do it or what it would feel like would help them in real life to get better at things. And so that was one of the things I liked about the film was the idea, you can mutate the things around you in your dream, and how different from reality that is, or different from your waking life, I guess.
Yeah, and I think there might actually be some merit in that, in using your dreams as a tool to handle things in your real life. Like I for some reason, I'm having like a memory of that actually happening to me. Like I think I was struggling with some kind of problem. I mean, not like a personal issue, just like a math problem, as an example. And then I dreamed about it, and I came up with a solution in my dream. And then the next day, I was able to go and solve the problem.
Yeah, I definitely know what you mean. I could talk about recurring dreams all day.
I'm just having an idea now that perhaps that's the way one should approach this movie, is that the movie feels like a dream. Treat it like a dream. Like, go into your dream and use this time to learn some philosophical point, glean something from these conversations that will help you in your real life.
Yes. Yeah, to better understand the nature of dreaming, maybe.
Well,
yeah. And that's
the nature of life itself. That's how I feel about every one of these conversations. You guys say that you have a hard time getting involved with them. I can't get myself out of them when I watch this movie. I just want to listen to every word that they have to say because I think there's some great speakers.
It's not to say that I wasn't interested. I just found myself, because these are conversations I think I've had before. And they're really, except there's just a couple of them where I felt like, these are concepts I've discussed with people before and kind of gone beyond the point that is being discussed. Like we've kind of traveled that ground and moved on to newer ground on that topic. But there were others that I thought were completely engaging. Like the one, towards the end with, it's actually Richard Linklater at the pinball machine. Talking about Philip K. Dick and that concept of how maybe all of time is actually one single point and we are just continually distracting ourselves from that. Like, I thought that was fascinating.
No, it was a good point. It's definitely a good way to end the movie because he's the last interview.
Yeah, he's there at the beginning, too, when he's in the back of the car, the boat car.
Yeah, in the boat car where the world is – yeah, ugh. I don't know. I feel like I could break down this whole movie scene by scene and talk about each of the ideas. But I understand that some of these are pretty basic philosophical concepts.
And at the same time, even though it's got these kind of grandiose concepts and is such an intellectual film, it feels extremely personal for Richard Linklater. Like, I feel like we're getting a glimpse into his psyche and his, like, kind of everyday mind. And I think some further evidence of that is I recognized several characters from other Linklater films.
Well, the protagonist.
I'm not that familiar with his work, his other films.
I'm not too familiar, but I recognize there was Ethan.
Sure.
Yeah, I haven't seen that, actually, so I'm sure there was characters from that in there. I had just kind of the feeling after seeing all the others. And there was Ethan Hawke and, I always space her name, Julie Delpy. From Before Sunrise and Before Sunset.
Yep.
I think they were playing the same
characters. Oh, right.
They were playing the same characters, yeah.
Yeah, and as well as the guy driving around with the megaphone in his car is taken from Linklater's, one of his earlier films, Slacker, which is one I've seen, which is kind of a similar film, except it's, live action. But it just goes from character to character with really no plot, and it just moves from scene to scene through one character leaving one scene and going into the other.
Right.
So in that regard, it was kind of similar, except with Waking Life, we follow the one guy through scene to scene. And there were just little things throughout the film that I found myself just fascinated by. Like one where he's talking to the dude in the chair, the kind of punky dude, and talking about how, if you ever think you're dreaming, go and turn off the light and see if you can. He had a pin on his collar that every time the camera came back to him, it was a different pin. It was something different.
I don't know if I've ever noticed that before. The guy that's playing the ukulele?
No, it's the other guy in the room. It's like after he moves away from the ukulele guy, he's talking to the guy.
Oh, he's talking to the punk rocker. Yeah, okay, I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, his pin on his collar, every time the camera comes back to him, it's different. It's something different. And I thought that was kind of one of those interesting little details that you might not notice.
I had noticed that, and I like that. I also like just that sentence. And it seems like Linklater seems to know a lot about lucid dreaming. He has to have written the film, because that is one of the totems that I was aware that works for some people, like one of the ways that some people actually catch themselves dreaming and from that point take control of their dream is to try to turn off the light. Another one is to look at your hands, and if anything's wrong number of fingers, something like that. Sometimes I it seems like the brain gets hands wrong a lot. Just a lot of stuff. Oh, I can't remember other ones.
Hold
your breath and see if you can still breathe.
Yeah, I usually discover it because I find a piece of something in my life that doesn't exist anymore. Like, I'll be living at my parents' house.
Yeah.
And then I'll be like, whoa, I don't live here. But I did live here, Things like that are usually the telltale signs for me. I don't ever try to remember to turn off, but clocks never work for me either. Oh, man. It just reminds me of a dream that's recurring. It's probably my most recurring dream. It's actually at my parents' house growing up, and I'm just jumping on a trampoline, but I'm getting such high air that I'm four times higher than my roof of my house.
That's awesome.
And it's one of those dreams that just – that feeling you get on certain roller coasters of your stomach dropping?
Oh, yeah.
And so I'm feeling that over and over and over, and I'll usually wake up because my body will react and it'll kick me out of a dream, but it's kind of a terrifying dream.
That's the kick.
Yep.
Yeah, kicks are crazy. Like, I had a couple of those where I was dreaming I was playing soccer, and I went to kick the ball, and, like, my leg actually moved in real life across the bed, and it woke me up.
Yeah. The muscle memory attached to your brain.
Yeah.
It's
oh, it's fascinating.
It's great. It's terrifying. Have you ever woken up but your body didn't? And this is the scariest thing that's ever happened.
Oh,
I hope it never
paralysis.
Happens. Dream paralysis. You wake up and you can see the world that's real and your eyes can move, but the rest of your body is not there. You feel truly paralyzed, and it is probably the most frightening thing that's ever happened to me.
Wow.
Yeah. And
I've never experienced that, but I've heard from a lot of people. It's relatively common, actually. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm not the only person I've talked to that's ever experienced this phenomenon, but I don't recommend it. So essentially, imagine that you're just laying face down on a pillow and you wake up and your eyes are there and you're thinking, or so you think, but you can't move the rest of your body at all. And you're just trying so desperately just to move your arm, but nothing's happening.
No, never experienced that.
Yeah, I wouldn't deal with that well. I don't think I'd like that at all.
No, it's not the proper way to wake up out of sleep. It's not. No, I'm not. One of my friends quotes, I woke up today, and you know how mad that makes me. You know, that's kind of the attitude that you get from an experience like that. Well, anyway, I guess we probably talked enough about waking life.
Sure.
Talked about dreams a lot.
Well, it is the subject of dreams.
Right, yeah. And I think waking life, more than the other two, are about the experience of dreams. Like what it actually is like to dream, but like a science of sleep is more about kind of the differentiation between dreams and the real life,
or the lack thereof.
Let's move on to that one. That's my pick. I picked it because I love this film. I remember seeing it for the first time probably 2 or 3 years ago and just being completely charmed by it. I think it's sweet, almost sappy to a degree, and I just thought it was so imaginative, and I was so glad they went with like stop motion animation and like constructed elements for the dreams, because that kind of added to that layer of sweetness and kind of authenticity. Because if it was all computer graphics, I don't think this would have really worked.
Well, and that's Michel Gondry. That's what he's known for, is music videos with the insistence not to use CGI. And Eternal Sunshine is very much that way. Yeah, that's just what he does. And I agree with you. Here, it's like it was more imaginative and more layered than in anything else I've seen from him.
Yeah, and I think he wrote the script, too. So I think it's a more personal film. And it's actually, I think it's one of my favorite films just because of like how much I can relate to the main character and just that inability to kind of communicate and defend himself to the world around him. And so he kind of has to escape into a fantasy world of his own machinations.
Yeah, it is a personal film. I was actually kind of annoyed by the main character every now and then. Like he seems a little bit whinier than I wanted him to be. But
yep.
He's really creative and really just has a love of creating things that is really interesting, like his room and his TV set made of cardboard and everything. Every now and then, it's like you can't help but love him, and then every now and then you can't help but hate him, and then the rest of the time he's somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, it's like I really related to that creative element.
I think Michel Gondry is kind of a better artist than he is a writer. It's kind of how I felt about this movie. I felt that it was a joy to look at, and I thought it was well cast, but I kind of didn't really care about the characters at all. I mean, I really tried, but I kind of didn't really associate a whole lot with the lead. I don't know. It's hard to explain how I feel about this, but I don't know. I just wasn't terribly involved. It didn't feel like his motives or what he was actually trying to accomplish really was worth all the effort.
Well, expand on that. What do you mean?
I don't know. I'm probably going to have to think about it more, but it was just more visually appealing to me than it was based off of a narrative and the dialogue and the characters. I mean, I thought some of the characters were fine, but I didn't think they were very deep. I thought they were more of caricatures.
Yeah, they were more a vehicle for creative images.
Exactly. He was trying to drive a plot and story just to create beautiful looking sets and scenes.
Hmm. But I don't know. It seems to me like the characters and the elements of the plot and the dreams, the beautiful parts of it to look at, kind of bounce back and forth off of each other. But there is sort of a plot here of a man who can't express himself, trying to win the affection of his neighbor, and then every time he comes close to succeeding, he kind of backs away or sabotages himself. And I think that's real. That sounds a lot like myself, almost even. And I think that's relatable. And then I liked how the dreams would pick up things not only visually from his real life and then incorporate them in impossible ways or aesthetically apply it in a different way you wouldn't have thought of, but also thematically, I don't know, I have a hard time describing my feelings about it too, even though they're more favorable. It's just, it was really well meshed together, like a weird web that kept building on each other, on itself. And the dreams just got more and more complex, incorporating parts of the characters, I guess.
Yeah, so I guess I'm kind of in a position to defend the film a little.
I don't think you need
not
to defend
to say that
it.
You guys are.
I'm just being hard on Michel Gondry because I like this movie. I think that he's, you know, I was just trying to point out that I think that he's better visually than he is as a writer.
Yeah, and I could probably concede that criticism. But for me, I don't know what it is exactly, but I thought the story worked. I thought it succeeded completely. Probably because there is really no resolution. And I think I can see where you're coming from with the kind of unauthentic feel of the characters, because I found myself questioning whether or not this main character really was interested in the neighbor, or if he was just stoked to finally have some kind of human connection with anyone. And so he kind of latched onto that, because you could definitely tell he's way more comfortable in his dream worlds. And those are the worlds he's kind of, you know, built in his own mind. So when he's, you know, so when he's actually in his real life, I don't know, he's so awkward and uncomfortable.
But I think that's the cool part about this, is it's a story about a man who has a very developed self-interior life, meet someone he would like to be a part of that life, but like, how do you blend reality with your dreams? And I think it has a dual meaning of dream here. It's kind of his desires as well as his literal, you know, REM cycle dream life, where he's a pretty active, lucid dreamer himself. He seems to have control over what goes on in his dreams most of the time, and just trying to blend that with reality was interesting.
Yeah, I guess maybe I was judging a little too harshly, thinking now. Because I guess in the dream, his characters are free reign to be as ridiculous as they want, because I kind of concede that to being in a dream world. But I feel like the characters outside of the dream world were a little bit too much of a caricature to be real.
I thought that too, but then I wondered if maybe it's just because I'm American that I was...
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe. I have no idea how the French culture is. I've never been to France, really. So.
Yeah, maybe it didn't ring false for me because I've seen so much French cinema and these characters were acting like I've come to expect, you know, a French character to act.
Yeah.
So that might be why. But also, I, especially with the coworkers, I can see where your criticism is, because those are definitely caricatures of something. There's really no underlying persona there. That's just kind of a vehicle for other things for the main character. Like, especially
right.
with Guy, like, that's definitely a father figure. And that is very well represented. I noticed this. This is the first time I've noticed this. The first day he shows up for work, Guy is wearing the beanie cap thing, the wool cap. And then from there on,
yep.
after that, you only see the main character wearing that hat. It's like he's latched on to this character as kind of a father figure. And it's definitely not a good example. And I think that has consequences later on.
I didn't notice that.
I had noticed that, and I thought it was strange. And I thought it was just, I saw it more as like a really deep, like philosophical, like symbol of like that Guy kind of represented expectations, what was expected of him, his job, you know, come on, talk to this woman, you know, do this, dance, all of these things, and him adopting that as his expectation for himself, was like over his head. Maybe that's going too far. Maybe just the father figure makes sense. But in either case, it's pretty much the same idea that he's adopted something from this character, Yi.
Yeah, that's one thing about Gondry I love is those just attention to the small details like that, like all the little creative things in his room that end up in his dreams and all of that. And to go back to the concept of like the lucid dream that Clayton was talking about, I don't know that it's necessarily that. I think his dreams actually have more control over him than he does over his dreams. Like especially towards the end when his dream world kind of takes over his real world. Like, he's in such a state of panic that he can't differentiate the two, and it totally blows up on him.
Yeah, toward the end, I would agree. But it seemed like toward the beginning, you know, he was using his dream as a way to seem more outgoing to himself, to explain his motives and his desires to himself. I don't know. I actually, the first time I watched this, I was really, really disappointed. And that's because of my blind adoration of Eternal Sunshine, and I saw, oh wow, you know, Michel Gondry's got a new movie coming out, this one he wrote, I'm really excited, you know. And then I saw it, and I think some of the reasons that this time watching through it I loved it were some of the reasons that I disliked it the first time seeing it when it first came out. Was that 06?
Yeah, 2006.
Yeah, in 2006. What was some of the construction paper type aesthetic, the cardboard aesthetic of the dreams and the water, the profane water and things like that. I don't know. I just didn't feel as much of a connection to the characters my first time through the movie as I did this time. But this time through the movie, I just really enjoyed it. I just allowed myself to enjoy the ride. And still I wouldn't rank it with Eternal Sunshine, but I think Michel Gondry is incredibly inventive, really skilled person.
Yeah, that's such a fascinating phenomena where I also had expectations going in because of Eternal Sunshine. And I will admit, I mean, you put these two next to each other, Eternal Sunshine is going to win hands down. But I actually like Science of Sleep better. I wouldn't say it's a better film, but I think I connect to it deeper than I do Eternal Sunshine. And I don't know. I really don't know why. I think it's because I've got a little bit of that character in me, of that one who just wants to connect with people so bad that I end up self-sabotaging it all the time. And that creative element
Jim,
where...
Jim Carrey's character in Eternal Sunshine as well.
Yeah, true. But I think the imaginative nature of the dreams in this one kind of put it over the top for me. I mean, the effects of Eternal Sunshine were phenomenal. But this one just had this spark, this element of charm and kind of childlike creativity that I just really related to and connected to.
I can hear you on that one.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of takes me back to, you know, Christmases when I was like 7, 8 and I'd get Lego sets and just stay up all night building stuff.
Well, I thought those were the most charming scenes in the whole movie is when he's with the other girl that he's interested in. I can't remember her name. And they're talking about doing the movie and putting the forest inside the boat, the trees inside the boat. I thought those were the best scenes in the movie. Well, aside from the leaving a note on the door when he's completely naked, that was classic. But
yeah,
but I don't know. Compared to Eternal Sunshine, it's not fair. Eternal Sunshine has the Charlie Kaufman benefit. You know, it's gonna be hard to really fight with that.
Oh, side note, real quick, we should do a Kaufman episode.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah, that would be great.
Maybe I'll put it down. So sorry to interrupt. I probably just totally fucked the flow of the episode.
You did not fuck the flow.
I appreciate The Science of Sleep also for being the first movie to make me fall in love with Charlotte Gainsbourg. And then there were two others. Oh, what are they? Well, recently, Antichrist. And then also, I'm Not There. Yes, I'm Not There.
Was she in that?
I always confuse with I'm Still Here. But it's I'm Not There she's in. And she's just beautiful. I don't know. Something about her. And she's got
something. It might be her talent.
Possibility.
I mean, not to say that she's not attractive. But I mean, if you just look at her, I mean, she looks kind of homely. But she's got that certain something that kind of just puts her out there.
It's the eyes. It's always the eyes.
Is it?
Yeah.
Her eyes.
Maybe it's her. I mean, having seen Antichrist since seeing this, it kind of definitely peppers the perception.
She's scary in that, but she's also
terrifying.
disturbing kind of beauty also.
I think the first place I saw was 21 Grams, actually, but that's before I knew who she was.
You know, I don't know which I saw first, this or 21 Grams, but it's been, I don't know, I really have very little memory of 21 Grams. I remember liking it, but I don't remember her in it at all.
Yeah, that's one. I've seen that a couple of times, and just like you, I have trouble remembering specifics. I don't know if it's because it's so dark and depressing that it kind of removes itself from your consciousness.
No.
But I know what it's about. I know major elements of the film, but I have trouble remembering specifics.
It's not a light movie.
No, heavy. And back to dreams in The Science of Sleep. I really liked the little details that kind of rang true about what it is to be dreaming. Like, voices were dubbed in and didn't match up to lip movement. I especially like the scenes where his hands got super huge. That's just a fun little scene.
But that is also an image which Michel Gondry had used before this movie in
really?
A Foo Fighters music video.
Oh, that's right.
And then
ooh.
I think, I don't know, probably the Flaming Lips borrowed from Michel Gondry, because they'll do that off stage as well, I think, have giant
yeah.
hands. But yeah, that is one. I was actually kind of bothered by that. I was like, okay, that's cool. And that's something that could happen in dreams. I could see why he would use it again, but he's just borrowing from himself.
I believe it actually happened to him in a dream, and it's from a recurring dream, which is why he continually adds into stuff. But that's no excuse. That's no excuse.
And actually, now that I think about it, that Foo Fighters video is about dreaming as well. He goes through a bunch of different dreams. Each of the different band members is in a different dream, and then they all come together and fight evil or something like that.
All right, then.
All right.
Anything else?
No, I figure if we don't have anything to say, no
yeah.
one. Yeah.
Yeah. Time to move on.
Well, then, let's hop over to Paprika.
One of the most useless.
Paprika, I selected because I thought it was just, like, really fun. When the first time I saw it because I was talking about Inception with somebody, and they said, if you like that, you have to see Paprika. And I think that I would agree that it deals with false awakenings in a way that I like better than Inception. There's still a sense of urgency, something that you have to get done in the dreams, and the dream is kind of working against the protagonist in trying to accomplish what their goals. I like that it is a sci-fi movie, kind of, with the invention of technology that doesn't currently exist, which is cool. You know, they make these machines that make it possible for a therapist to see their patient's dreams so that they can treat them and diagnose their dreams, sort of. And then that technology gets stolen and all hell breaks loose. Everybody's looking at each other's dreams, and there's dream feeding back and forth, and it just is growing and presents a danger to people in the waking world. I don't know, a different kind of like action movie where there's a clear physical danger presented to people. And I don't watch very much anime, so you won't see me select very much anime, but I wanted this opportunity to select this film.
It was a good choice. This is one of the movies where I watch and I wish I spoke fluent Japanese, because there's so much to see visually that it's a shame that I had to read subtitles at all. It definitely merits repeat viewing for me, just from a visual level. I think it was some anime is just blows my mind.
Yeah, it's just so ingenious, like, to think of this kind of story and to be able to adeptly translate it into a visual medium. I think it's probably about 10 or 15 minutes into it, I was like, whoa, this is going a lot deeper than I was expecting, and this is going to be brilliant. But I think the comparison to Inception is definitely valid. Actually, after seeing this, I was glad I didn't pick Inception for this category, because I was kind of thinking I should have, because that's
right.
such a badass movie. But this has the same kind of element of dream invasion and how a dream can be an actual physical place that someone else can go into.
I believe Chris Nolan has cited Paprika as an inspiration for Inception.
Yeah. Oh, well, that makes sense, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So,
but then this goes further that, you know, the dream world can actually come out and invade the real world.
Yeah, that part, the first time I watched it, I was confused. I was really confused. Like, wait, what is going on? Where are they? Is this a dream or is it reality? And I think the movie tries to get that reaction a little bit. And definitely in the times when there are false awakenings that the characters experience, that you experience it as a viewer as well, which is cool. But the second time watching it, it felt a lot more like, oh, wow, I understand what's going on. And it was even more enjoyable. So.
Yeah, I thought it was very effective on kind of keeping you on your toes as to whether or not certain scenes were in the dream world or in reality.
Yeah, I also like, I always have a hard time with remembering the names of characters that are Asian. But is it for Hijiru? Or the first one that they suspect has stolen the technology is the assistant to the doctor who invented the DC Mini, the device that they use. But the elements of his dream that start to seep into everything else of that kind of parade of different animals and things. The first time I saw it, I was just like blown away. I kind of had this feeling that not only is it just like it's a mashup of different like images and things that are supposed to be a part of that person's psyche, but also it seems oddly American, like an overstimulation, overconsumption. There's even a bouncing around Statue of Liberty in there, and it seemed almost like a criticism of westernization or westernized living or something. And it just really cool to look at. Vivid colors, fast paced. That's one of the reasons I like this movie so much, is it's just pretty and complex.
Yeah, I thought the batshit crazy parade was awesome and terrifying at the same time. Like after, you know, the first couple of times when you start hearing that music and you see those frogs, you're like, oh shit. And then at the point where that parade actually breaks into the real world and you're still kind of spending the next couple of minutes wondering, now, is this the dream or is this actually in reality? And then you kind of get that confirmation like, yeah, this is reality. And that crazy parade is now manifest in the real world. And I just kind of put myself in that situation thinking that would just blow my mind. Like, how do you process something like that?
A dream parade in your real
life. Terrifying. Yeah. You'd probably think you were dead. Like, what is this, hell? What is this?
I can't even, I don't even know what I would do. It would be like the worst Macy's Day experience.
Yeah, I'm not like, really a fan of parades. I don't think I've ever gone to a parade that I've actually enjoyed. I don't think I would like that at all.
Yeah, this is the only way you could make a parade worse. If the things were alive, those creepy dolls like rolling over each other, all talking at the same time.
Inanimate objects that are parading around are not good.
Scary.
This movie is just too crazy to talk about.
Kind of. I'm trying to articulate some of the images and concepts. Like, I guess one kind of issue I had was at the end when it's revealed that you've got these opposites, whatever the lists were, and then one was man, woman, and something about the spice of life or whatever, and it's like paprika. It's like, oh, okay, all right, that's all falling into place now. And it just seemed a little heavy-handed at that point. Like, it was too much of a finger snap, like, oh, of course, yeah.
Paprika.
Oh,
I get it.
Paprika.
And then for the little girl to, you know, suck in all the evil dream world and grow bigger and bigger till it was, you know, the two figures there. I don't know. Something about that just wasn't necessarily working for me, but I also wouldn't know where else the film could go.
I wasn't exactly sure what I wanted to happen, but I was a little bit discontented with the ending myself. It kind of was like this Mononoke-ish deal. Less good, though. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess. And another thing I wanted to talk to you guys about is this is rated R.
Really?
Is it?
Yeah, and I really am not sure why, except for that maybe one creepy scene in the dream where the one dude essentially assaults Paprika.
Oh, yeah.
Tearing the shell in half, but it's done in a kind of, you know, uncomfortably sexual way. But other than that, there's like no language. There's really no nudity except for the two figures at the end. But those are fantastical figures. So I don't know why this would be rated R.
Well, there's the suicide, people jumping off buildings. There's some blood with that. I guess they're not suicides.
Usually
well,
violence
oh,
is
yeah,
going
to
get you an R rating. It's usually language or sex or nudity.
It was the Japanese.
The
that's what it was.
Overly bloody. It'll get you.
Yeah. But you can get away with a damn large amount of violence in a PG-13 movie.
Yeah, I mean, look at Dark Knight, for example. That's a super violent movie, but there's really no blood. But as far as tonally goes, you know, that probably is an R-rated film. I mean, if we're trying to be consistent with ratings, which I never really pay attention to.
I wasn't aware that this was rated R.
Yeah, this it was kind of an afterthought for me. After I pulled the disc out and put it back in the Netflix sleeve, I saw it said rated R, and I was like, really? Why?
Yeah. I haven't paid attention to the ratings since they stopped dictating whether or not I could see a movie.
The same. And on IMDb, it says rated R for violent and sexual images. I don't know. There's no sense to it. But I just thought that was an interesting point to bring up. Because, I mean, this essentially is an animation. I mean, it's geared towards adults, I imagine. But.
Yeah, it seems geared toward adults to me.
I think it might be a little too crazy for people to understand that are too young.
I guess that's true. I mean, I imagine if I was like 13 and saw this batshit crazy parade and people jumping off buildings and stuff, I'd be like, well, that's interesting. Then again, I saw like Ghost in the Shell and Ninja Scroll. Those are crazy animations. I thought I was around that age.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and whether the content is really made for adults or not is not the question. It's whether younger people should be prohibited from seeing it in theaters and things like that. Prohibited being sold to. I don't know.
Yeah,
the MPAA is just so crazy.
That's bullshit.
It's all right. I'm excited to start rating books when that's going to start happening.
Yeah.
I guess people don't read books anymore.
Not really.
So maybe not.
You know, books are the last safe haven, I think, if people actually read them.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so I guess we're done with Paprika.
We were talking about Paprika. My final thought on Paprika is that it takes an ambitious amount of people to work on a film to make it that good as the source material. I think the ideas and descriptions that were probably in the script or in the book that was written that this is based off of are probably just as wild, and I think that they probably did an awesome job. I mean, I can't say for sure because I haven't read the source material, but I give props to the creativity involved in this movie.
Like, there wasn't any filler at all.
No, it was just scene after scene of really interesting stuff, I thought.
Beautiful.
Yeah, that reminds me of the ending. And how you can tell that whoever put this together just loved film. Because of how, at the end, the cop kind of... I mean, throughout the entire film, it seems like he's got some kind of apprehension about going to the movies. Because of his experience with trying to make a movie in his youth. And at the end, through his experience and the whole experience of, you know, everyone getting invaded by that dream state, last scene is him going to the theater and buying a ticket to see a movie. I actually almost started to choke up a little bit at that because I could relate so deeply to that love of film and just going and buying a ticket and just being completely immersed in a world that someone has created.
Yeah, I liked that for a couple reasons, because he was clearly a person with a film background from some of his terminology that he knew, but that it represented also that he'd grown as a character, gotten over something, and that the whole experience in this case for him, you know, changed him. And so I thought that was a great ending as well, a great moment.
To get involved in the discussion, you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/3filmegos, follow us on Twitter, @3filmegos, or email us at 3filmegos@gmail.com. You can also comment at 3filmegos.podomatic.com, where you can also donate and subscribe to the show. Music provided by 90s Television. You can hear more of their music on Facebook. On our next episode, Ghosts. We've been the 3 Film Egos. Thanks for listening.